And what we expect of a Hadamard transform is an operator of this form. And of course, the generators of a Hadamard transform is a rotation about the 1, 0, 1 direction, right? And so if I think about the generator of a Hadamard, it's a combination of an X and Z operator. And what we had on the board, which I used, was this operator, which you would recognize as the generator of this rotation is actually a sigma y rotation, right? So that here I have a rotation theta about the y-axis. And I shouldn't have just said, it's a Hadamard. I mean, what I was trying to say, and say poorly, was that we create a superposition state. And for a computer science, we typically think about that as a Hadamard transform. But the difference, of course, between these two is some details of the superposition you get out, but really that the generators are along different axes. Yeah? Okay, so that was one question. There was a question about, in the Choi matrix formalism, where there were two points there. One, I referred to the Zeeman interaction in that. And of course, in the so far, in the work we've been doing with neutrons, we haven't introduced the Zeeman interaction. The point calling it a Zeeman interaction is that there was an energy splitting between the two spin states. And again, just we think about that as a Zeeman interaction because the only thing that will split spin is a magnetic field. And the mapping of the path to qubits is similar to the mapping of the of qubits to spin. Now, that lecture notes that I gave you for lecture two are generic. There's nothing in there actually that refers to neutron interferometry. They're just written for general qubit dynamics. And then in the lecture notes for the Choi matrix, we need to go from the Pauli matrix to the transition basis. And of course, if I have SU4, then I can write down things. We normally do write down things in the Pauli basis. The transition basis is a more natural basis for looking at actions. And it is exactly as one would think it should be. We're looking at the transitions. Of course, and it's a complete basis. It's easy to transform between. And I give you the transformation between those two. Okay, so I'm not going to, in this class, derive why the Choi matrix is the right way to get the Krauss operator sum. If you look at Joseph Emerson's lecture notes, you will find that in great detail. Perfect. All right. Okay, somehow we're not getting, this is my computer. That's right. And it's only a question of what is the observed phase that we see in an experiment. Okay. And so there, you have to be careful of what the phase is that you're seeing when you have a mirror. And if I have a photon coming in, so we have an electromagnetic wave coming in to a mirror, then there's a phase shift. In this case, the phases that we do see, this is the correct approach for it. Now, you could take the you can take the fact that this is a sigma y rotation, right? Take and write, take your neutron interferometer and add another qubit to say, hey, that this path is allowed. Okay, look at the dynamics, then trace over the central qubit and renormalize. And you'll get an effective operator out of that. And so you can see the physics. Other questions? Okay, let me see if I can. Next year, we're going to have so much room.
Yes.
It's going to be wonderful. Well, I'm not sure that you need to apologize. I'll go and talk to Neil and say, hey. Okay, I meant to show you a few things. Maybe you've seen them already on the website. This is what these single-blade neutron interferometers actually do look like. This is 10 to 20 centimeters. So these are big balls of silicon that we machine out. They're incredibly fragile. And it turns out that you... they're expensive to get the silicon. There takes about a year to machine and etch them. And then the experience in the community is about 1 in 50 work. And so, you know, don't make that your graduate career, okay? Okay. This is what the overall facility looks like. And what we have here, that I won't be able to show you very well, is we have a beam line here with lots of neutrons, about 10 to the 14 neutrons per second going down this beam line. The beam is big. And then in the beam line, we have a small crystal, pyrolytic graphite in this particular case, that takes a small amount of the neutrons in the beam and it sends it to a separate crystal here, which then sends the beam through this flight tube into another crystal here. The flight tube isn't that important for the neutron properties, but it's very important that you confine your beam so that somebody walking around doesn't walk through your neutron beam. And you know, you wouldn't know that until later. And then we have this shielded room that is temperature controlled to two parts in a thousandth of a degree. Then we have this temperature controlled room, which is controlled to one part in a thousandth of a degree. Then we have this temperature enclosure, which is as well done as this one. We've got the neutron interferometer is here. There's a small vibration control, then there's a bigger vibration control, then there's a bigger vibration control, and then there's a bigger vibration control beneath this. And so, you know, the whole thing works really well for getting rid of vibrations. It works really, really, really well for getting rid of neutrons. We have 10 to the 14 neutrons per second here. We have one neutron per second at the detector. But it's exactly that one that we want. So we get reasonable signals. So the neutrons come in from the left and then go through that, I'm sorry, I'm colorblind, the thing that's pointed to, that flight tube, and then comes into there. Why are the neutrons lost? They're lost because of the solid angle. That we have a small source, which is effectively like a point source in the scattering arrangement, and then we move away from it by about 8 meters effectively. By the time you get out there, there's no neutrons. Because what happens is as the temperature drifts, then the crystal changes dimension just a little bit. And what will happen is you'll pick up another phase shift, right? It's as though you're taking your interferometer and stretching it a little bit. And since we have so few neutrons, the experiments are long. And so if we have a small change, and we get a small drift in the phase, and of course if we're averaging over these events, then we see a loss of contrast. You had a question?
So we need to have one particular wavelength of the neutron exactly like that. So I've exaggerated, as you said. The neutron is coming into the facility.
Let me show you this first, and I'll go back to that. Have a variety of wavelengths. So this is a good schematic of the reactor. So here we have the core. The core, of course, gives off a flood of neutrons. They come, a small part of them, come into this cooled region where we have liquid hydrogen. So we keep the liquid hydrogen at about 20 degrees Kelvin. And the neutrons scatter off the hydrogen, so they thermalize with that. And then they're directed towards a beamline that comes out this way. Okay, so that all of the neutrons coming out have some equivalent temperature. The equivalent temperature is about 20 Kelvin. And so if we look at the Boltzmann spectrum for that, okay, I don't give you exactly for 20 Kelvin, but you get a spread. And we're selecting out those, in this particular experiment, those neutrons that have 1,800 meters per second, and the precision of that is about 0.05%. So we're taking a small slice of that. Good. Now I want to show you, the reason I did all this is to show you the actual data. Remember that what we should see is a contrast curve, that as we adjust the phase, so the bottom axis, the horizontal axis is phase. And remember, we got that phase by changing the effective width of a piece of polished silica. So that's why it's in a length scale. And then you see the two output beams, the O beam and the H beam, and you see the contrast. Remember that what you would like to see that both of these go to zero. Right? That would be perfect contrast. And both of those go to a full intensity. And this is as good as it gets. And so we're going to talk about why that isn't the case, and then what it means for the experiments. Okay? Good. Yeah?
Asymmetry between the O beam and the H beam.
Yeah,
and that's because if you didn't have the phase flag, then the H beam would be zero, right?
So hold the question, okay. And we will look at that. Okay. So we've got, again, our neutron interferometer.
Our blades, and now I'm going to write the blades in terms of for a general angle here, but of course the width chooses theta, so theta is fixed in any experiment. Of course, phi we can change, and then we're going to project out over that. And now, what we're going to do, of course, is just go through and calculate what happens as a function of theta. But we can look at the two extreme cases. So I can take that I have a transmission and a reflection probability. And the transmission probability is going to go as cosine of theta, and the reflection probability is going to go as sine theta, or both of those squared, in fact. And they better add up to 1.
Yeah.
Now, look at what happens if the blade is perfectly transmitted. Okay, so now we say that there's no probability that it's reflected. The beam is just transmitted. If the beam is just transmitted, then it comes through. Now, I have to lie to you for a second and say, oh well, this is still going to be a mirror. And of course, if it's perfectly transmitted, it's not going to be a mirror. But of course, if it was perfectly transmitted, you know, it wouldn't ever hit our detector either, right? And so the only pieces of this perfect transmitted piece I want are those that hit the detector. So I'm still going to put a mirror here. So it's perfectly transmitted. And perfectly transmitted by me says, that it takes that time. Can you tell the difference between those? That's good. So in perfect transmission, this path goes exactly to the edge. In perfect transmission, if I had this path, you know, if we want to talk about a model, we better talk about the unitary dynamics. If I want something to be unitary, I better know what happens to all the basis states that go in, right? So even though we don't have neutrons here, it's important to understand what would happen if we put the neutrons here. And here, of course, if it's perfectly transmitted, it goes to the O beam. So the perfect transmitted case says that we swap the O and the H. Okay, and of course, there's no coherence. We just swap the O and the H. What happens if it's perfectly reflected? Well, if it's perfectly reflected, the exact same thing happens. If it's perfectly reflected, then O goes to H, and the other inputs will go to O. Okay? So what we're going to find about this is we're going to end up with a very simple model. We're going to end up with a model that says, if I have a real neutron interferometer, then I can treat the dynamics of the neutron interferometer as equal to the probability that I have the right thing. So plus the rest of it, where the only thing that happens is that I flip the process. And I calculate in my notes what axis I want that by. And it's nice to get the right axis in this case. So what happens is that it's a rotation about the x-axis. So this U error is equal to e to the I pi over 2 sigma x. Now here I'm saying that it switches the two, right? But that's a pi rotation. But you remember that there's always a factor of 2 if we're using polys. Okay, so we'll get so this I haven't proven yet. I've just given you a simple model that says, hey, there's the errors that we see. And since we see those errors, I can describe what happens correctly with the errors. Okay? And I'm going to abstract that, hey, that there should be something that happens correctly with the interferometer. Now, let's take a few moments and do it correctly. doesn't work. Oops. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so we take and look at our experiment. So I define here the outcome as saying that I have a general rotation of the blade. Remember that is this Y rotation, I think, but it's either Y or X. By some angle, the mirror, the phase rotation, and then the first blade, right? So it goes the in, first blade, phase, mirror, last one. So again, I've done exactly what I did last time, inverting those two, but it doesn't make any bloody difference in the outcome. And then we see the results. Someday, I will remember to make the changes after a lecture. But don't count on it. So here is the O-beam intensity, okay, as the transmission coefficient, right? So that's the probability that I have transmission goes from 0 to 1. And, of course, there are only two things that can happen. The neutron is transmitted or it's reflected, right? And so if the transmission probability is 1, the reflection probability is 0. The transmission probability is 1/2. The reflection probability is 1/2. And then on this axis, I've plotted the phase. And on the third axis, the O-beam intensity. And we see exactly what we would like to see, that there's no contrast in the two cases where the transmission coefficient is deterministic, 0 or 1. And right at the middle part, there's this beautiful contrast, and the contrast is full. And if we go down and we look at the H-beam intensity, of course, it is exactly the complement of the O-beam intensity. And we see a nice picture. And if I vary the transmission coefficient, then you see that as I vary the transmission coefficient, the O-beam always grows from 0, and the H-beam always moves from 1, right? So if we went back and we looked at the experimental data, some of this looks right. Okay? It says yes. You know, the O beam is growing from 0, the H beam is coming down from the maximum intensity. But some of it looks wrong, right? The O beam doesn't actually get down to 0. Okay, so we don't have a full model of this. But in fact, we recover much of the details of the system. And we can start to ask, hey, if I have contrast, which is not 100%. And of course, you know, you build your neutron interferometer, you get some value. And that's it. You know, you can't go back and say, now I want to do it again. You can. You know, it takes you another year of machining. So you'd like to know how much with this model, how much can we actually say? Now, we see that this model, you know, it works. Everything's in there. We keep the transmission coefficient. But we don't need to keep all that. It's enough to say here, and you're going to show me this in your homework, that with this simple model, one parameter of the probability that what we've done, well, we've done the correct experiment with some probability given by how close the transmission and reflection coefficient is to 0.5. Right? So tell me what this probability is in terms of the transmission coefficient. And then we have this error, which screws up the analysis. It's a very simple error. All it says is that there's no coherence. It simply maps the input state to the other input state. Okay? This piece says, hey, there's no coherence. It looks like a classical noise coming into the problem. Now, I want to extend this picture a little bit for you. And in the Mathematica notebook, I'm not going to go over this. I give you that model. Okay, so I've recalculated the attenuation curves based exactly on that model, and I've plotted the exact same thing for you, the O-beam intensity, the phase, and now the probability of an error, right? Not the transmission coefficient, the probability of an error. And you can see that when the probability of no error, that when the probability, so it is just as I wrote it there. When the probability of no error is 1, we get beautiful contrast in the O and H beam. When the probability of doing the right thing is 0, we get no contrast. And we see that the O beam gives us no intensity in the H beam. So that label is wrong. Gives us full intensity. And the question I have to you is notice that here, as the probability increases, exactly as the model says, we get a linear change in the contrast, the depth of the modulation. Contrast is the depth of the modulation with the phase. Whereas up here, as I change the transmission coefficient, I don't see a linear change. What I see is this cosinusoidal change, right? And so I want you to connect these two plots for me to come up with a definition in terms of the transmission coefficient. What is the probability of an error? So I just want you to rescale this plot. Yeah, is that clear? You had a question.
So the source of the error, thank you for asking that question, often skipped too much. You've got your blade, and of course it has scattering sensors in it for Bragg scattering. And we choose the width of this blade. And so then I can say, okay, I have a plane wave coming in to this, yeah, so let's just say we have a plane wave with a certain momentum, it's a knot better, write it that way. It's going to scatter off of all of these centers, and we'll see the transmitted and the reflected piece, and of course, if I looked at it for all of these, it doesn't look that way, but they should be in phase if I put my spacing correctly with the circuit wavelength. The problem is the width of this. That if I take the width of this infinitesimally small, everything's transmitted. Right? As I make it longer and longer and longer, I get transmission and reflection. In this geometry, it is not possible to get full reflection. In the Bragg geometry, it is. In the Laon geometry, I actually can't get to the point where everything is reflected. But the problem is that we just don't have enough atoms to see the intensity of the Bragg peak being strong. Okay? And it's not that hard to calculate that effect. Though I doubt any of you have seen it. No one's seen dynamical diffraction theory.
Let me say, it's actually not that hard to calculate that, but the simple answer is the number of atoms and the probability of getting a Bragg reflection. So what we do is we design the width of the crystal to give us full contrast, and we machine it. But then we need to have that surface very highly polished. So after we machine it, we polish it, and then we chemically etch it. And you can't calculate how much material you're going to remove with the etching and with the polishing a priori. So we machine it to be a little bit thicker than it should be, and then we polish it, and then we etch it. And every time we do that, we go and we use X-rays, in fact. We look at X-ray scattering, because if I have neutrons at 2 angstroms, it's easy to have X-rays at 2 angstroms. And the X-ray intensity is much higher than the neutron intensity. And scattering is exactly the same. So we use X-rays to try to get the right width and to see that we have a coherence in the system. And then we keep doing this until we get the result that we're happy with. The problem is if you do it too much, you're going to start to destroy your system. So it's an iterative process of going through that, and we end up where we end up. Yeah? Other questions? Yeah.
The question is, so I understand, is the loss of contrast is not only because of Earth. It's also, you know, if you have pure transmission, then you don't have any contrast without the Earth, right?
That's right. So that's what we're saying here, is that if we have pure transmission, or we have pure reflection, then we don't have any contrast. We only get contrast from this term. This term will never give us contrast. And that's what we're seeing here, that we get contrast at that point where the transmission reflection coefficients are equal. We move away from that, we lose our contrast. Now, we also saw that in the real system, there's more things going on than just this.
The face is only one of the 2 points, right?
Yeah.
So you need, you know, to go through
the points. That's right. You can't see, of course, that face unless you have a coherence, right? Remember that if I give you a promise that the path, that the neutron is going to be either, let's say this as clearly as I can. If I give you a promise that the neutron was transmitted, even though it goes through a phase shifter, you don't see a phase, right? Because that becomes now a global phase. If I give you a promise that the neutron was reflected, you can't see that phase, again, because it's a global phase. And that's what this piece of the puzzle is telling us. It says, hey, this thing, let's just call it U-swap. Right, that's all it does. It swaps the paths. Absolutely no information about the phase, because whether I swap the paths, whenever I swap the paths, I have a phase which is a global phase, and the measurement's not going to depend upon it. All right. Now what I'd like to do is to look at a problem which maybe I should have looked at before last class,
to try to set up that lecture. But it relates to Tibor's point that there are other ways of getting a cross-section. I didn't need to put silica in the sample to get a cross-section. And in particular, the neutron has spin. And so there's a potential term that looks like the gyromagnetic ratio of the neutron times the field strength, of course, times the MZ quantum number. And I don't need to talk about it like that. Let's just put sigma z. We don't need to introduce any other parameters. Right, so there's a potential that depends upon the state of the neutron spin. And it's nice sometimes to go back and look at how even very simple experiments in physics can really get butchered. So I'm going to describe the butchering of an experiment, and then you'll correct it. So now we have a magnetic field that's coming out of the board, okay? And when one looks at this, at the contrast as a function of the magnetic field, you see that it decreases. I'm not going to draw the rest of the curve for you. As I increase the magnetic field, the contrast decreases. And this was published as an example of decoherence. It was published as an example that you would lose information in this system given that you had a magnetic particle. So let's go through the physics. So I say, okay, now I have the input state in some path, but now I need to add a degree of freedom, right? That we have the spin degree of freedom, and I've applied the magnetic field in the z direction. So B0 along the z direction. So therefore, the energy of the neutron spin is going to be recorded in the z quantum number of the spin, right? So we're going to use the z components of spin as a good quantum number. So I need to add spin to this system. So we've got our spin in the path. We've got a neutron in the path. And the input state that I want to look at is the identity state. So the identity state of spin says that it's equally likely that the spin is up or down, but there's no coherence, right? It is the spin is up or it's down. All right. So we have a state. Yeah, put a tensor product there if you like. Get the spin up, plus the spin down. And that's it, right? I want to write it this way to say, hey. And if you like, we'll throw in a factor of a half so that it looks like we're counting everything appropriately. Right? Half the spins are up, half the spins are down. And no coherence, just a projector. They're up, they're down. Okay. They go through the blade. What happens at the blade? Well, it gets split into two paths, right? But the blade is silica. The blade has no magnetic, silica is not magnetic, okay? And so the interaction of the blade is independent of spin. So we have our blade that we described before, U blade. But now, of course, I need to have an operator that's over SU4. And so we're going to take the Kronecker product of that with the identity matrix. And now I have an operator over SU4 that is independent of spin. So if you like, I'm sure you've seen all this before. We say that, yes, I have an operator that lives in a Hilbert space, and in this corner of the Hilbert space, this 2x2 piece of the Hilbert space, describes the path information for spin up. And this, the path information for spin down, and here, if there were coherences, and what we're saying is, we get the blade here, in here. It's exactly the same. The same thing, of course, is true for the mirror. It's true exactly for the next blade. So all of that we don't need to worry about. I'm still going to put in a phase flag here. This phase flag is, again, silica. So again, it has the same structure, that it's independent of the spin state. So the only place I need to worry about the spin state is over here where I put the magnetic field. And let me you have this model that the magnetic field is only over these regions. That's actually easy to arrange experimentally. So what are we going to see? Well, if I tell you that I have the neutron being transmitted, and we say that it has a perfect momentum, right? Then it's a plane wave. Okay? And now, you know, I take you back to your first quantum mechanics course, and I say, I have a jump in the potential of the plane wave. What happens? What's that?
Thank you. That's exactly right. So it gets sped up or slowed down depending upon the size, right?
And it will go back to its momentum here. Yes? And there's a path length here when we're in the field. What's going to be the effect of speeding up for some piece of time and then going back to the same speed on this plane wave? Yeah, that's right. We get to change in phase.
And I get to change in phase for the spin up state and the spin down state.
How? They're exactly opposite in signs, right? Because the potential depends upon sigma z, so it depends upon the sign of the state. And so the way you want to think about this is here, we have a spin-dependent phase. And so it looks like that for the spin-up state, I have, let's call it alpha. Let's do it here. For the spin up state, and for the spin down state, it looks like that. Okay? And now you should object to my picture. I apologize for that. Piece I want is the magnetic field over only one path. Okay? And that's what we've written here. We said if you're in the upper path, you pick up a phase, and if the spin was pointing up, that phase is positive. If you're in the lower path, you pick up a phase, and if you're in the lower path, you don't pick up a phase, regardless of the spin state. If you're in the negative spin state and you're in the upper path, you pick up a phase. That is opposite the sign of if you're in the spin up state.
Yeah. Minus I alpha and
yeah.
Plus I alpha.
Yeah, so plus I alpha and minus I alpha. Okay? So just to finish. Okay. That's all easy. Now, when we want to calculate correctly, given this physics, what's the outcome? We're going to go back to the last class and say, hey, the system was an incoherent mixture of spin being up and spin being down. Quantum mechanics is nicely linear. So I can describe the dynamics for spin up, and separately I can describe the dynamics for spin down. And then I can add those two together. Okay? And that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the analysis for spin up, where we will get this particular phase. Then we look at the analysis for spin down, and we get this particular phase. Now what happens at the helium 3 detector over here when I detect the neutron? You've had, of course, in nuclear physics.
No.
In this?
No.
No? Okay. You don't have to know. I'll tell you. was that the neutron is absorbed by helium-3. But helium-3 has spin. So if the helium-3 is polarized, then it'll only absorb neutrons with the opposite spin. So the helium-3 detector can be made spin sensitive. For most of the work that we do, however, we don't polarize the helium-3 detector. So the helium-3 detector is a pool of gas, and the helium magnetic states are exactly like the neutron states, half up and half down, and therefore there's always enough helium-3 in the right spin state to absorb the neutron. Okay, but later on, in a couple of classes, we'll look at what happens when I have helium-3 spin polarized, in which case it will only absorb the neutron of the opposite spin.
Does the detector work?
So the reaction is that we have a neutron interacting with helium-3. It gives down to tritium and a proton in about 700 kiloelectron volts.
And so these two come out as charged particles. And all we do, they come out as energetic charged particles. All we do is measure that charge. So it's very simple, right? Because you know, to measure charge is a piece of cake. And remember that this capture cross section is bloody huge. It's 5,000, more than 5,000 barns. So the probability, if I have a centimeter of helium-3, the probability of absorbing a thermal neutron is extremely high. So for these energies of neutrons, we can say that we never miss a neutron. Yeah.
Here, is that for unpolarized helium-3, dependence on V?
That's right.
And have you explained it, why it varies like that?
No.
Or not? Okay.
So, now then, we go and look at this piece. So the question was, let me show you that. Since the spin state is coming in incoherently, we don't need, in fact, to calculate the dynamics in SV4, right? Because there's nothing about the whole process which is going to change the spin state, right? The spin starts off in a certain state, it interacts with the blade, that leaves it in the spin state, it goes through a magnetic field, which slows it down or speeds it up, but it doesn't change the spin state. Goes through the mirror, goes through the phase shifter, goes through the last blade, goes to the detector. Never is there a process that changes the spin state. So just in trying to enforce this idea of incoherence, I calculate the resultant contrast for the up case and the down case separately. Okay, and the only thing that will be different here is this parameter B, which is the magnetic phase shift. Okay, so here it's minus B, there's plus B. So as I vary B, the magnetic cross section, then I see that the contrast goes away. Okay? And the statement in the literature, which we're going to beat up on,
is that this is decoherence. And the suggestion was, in fact, the experiment was published to prove this, that if I have only one spin state, that I would see the same thing. Okay? So now somebody tell me, why is it the contrast is going down? Right? So this is the O and the H being plotted together. Right? So I go back to the magnetic being zero, And as I increase the magnetic cross-section, we see a loss of contrast. So right?
There's a delay. So what would this look like if I measured it for the individual components of spin?
If you just had one spin?
Yes, let's say I just had one spin state.
Then you wouldn't lose contrast.
You would not lose contrast. See? You would publish an honest paper. So here I've taken the same plot, O and H, and I've looked at what happens with the two spin states. So the different colors are the two spin states. And of course what happens is that the two spin states, the phases move in opposite direction, right? So for each spin state, we still have full contrast, but because what we're observing is just the sum of both of those spin states, it appears that the contrast vanishes, right? And so I can have this beautiful case
where I have a high phase shift between the two magnetic states, and we completely lose contrast. And then as I increase the magnetic phase, of course I recover the contrast, right? So the contrast is periodic with the strength of the magnetic field, right? So because we have, just the one momentum going into there, there's the magnetic field, the spins are moving through it, they pick up one phase, and we see that. And so we get this nice periodic structure. This is what I want to describe as incoherence. So thinking back to last class, it's a mistake here to think about this experiment in terms of decoherence. In terms of decoherence, we would say that information is lost. No information is lost. And even worse, we wouldn't think that you could have seen these echoes, the contrast return, as a function of high magnetic field. Okay? And so it's important to as an experimentalist, that we keep the ideas of decoherence and incoherence separate in our mind, because they give us different ways of looking at the physics. Yes?
Coherence, you would also need some sort of environment that it's interacting with, right?
That's right. So for decoherence, we explicitly need some way that the information is lost. And, someone will tell me that, information is lost here when I make a measurement. Okay? And that's, of course, true. If I use a unpolarized helium 3 detector, I've lost that information. Okay? And so at that moment, I don't have any right to talk about the independent spin states because it's not there.
But I didn't need to lose that information, right? That information was my choice of losing. And I could have, for instance, I wanted to ask you that. I want you to show me that you can modify the experiment. Let me draw it here. Keep leaving my chalk over here. Let's say that I set this field so that there's no contrast observed. Okay? We can do that. It's easy enough to do. It says that, let me not calculate it for you. But it's easy enough to find that condition. Set that so there's no contrast. So now I know that if I look here, or I look here, I'm just going to see a flat curve. Half the neutrons end up there, half the neutrons end up here, and it doesn't matter how I set this phase. So no contrast. And now I want you to add a component to this that will return full contrast. Okay, I don't allow you to change the field. The field is fixed. Okay, but add a component to the experiment that will return full contrast. And I want you to think about two cases. One, add a component after the third blade. So that's called post-selection. Or add a component before. Okay? So that we prepare the sample differently, the neutron beam differently. Yeah. But show me that. Yeah.
What component
do
you need to?
Anything that that corresponds to some real physics. All right. Now, in the I give you a notebook, a separate notebook for the third lecture, that takes this model and then calculates the super operator for it, and then goes through, uses the Choi decomposition to get down the Krauss operators. And what, again, what do the Krauss operators tell you? The Krauss operators tell you for any particular experimental setup what the map is, what the action is. Okay? This picture tells you, in complete generality, for any setup, what it is. But we end up keeping a bit more than we really need to. The Krauss operators are going to be more compact representation of that. So have a look at that, and they'll give you some idea about the usefulness of the Krauss operators. Yep. And think about this problem. And let me know if this is a sufficiently convincing description of incoherence, because we're going to talk more about errors next class. But I want you to understand how these processes come to be. Okay, that they have a probability of some, in this term, a classical probability of over a set of unitaries. Why is it classical probability? Because the input state had two possible input states that were classically separated. The spin was up or the spin was down. In this particular case, it was 50-50, but it could have been anything, right? It could have been 80-20, could have been 90-10. You know, we could adjust that to anything we wanted, right? That's in our experimental control. And the last piece, just to convince you that we know what we're doing, no, I'm not going to show that. I'll let you go ahead and see that before yourself. We'll talk tomorrow. Any questions?
Yeah, that's what we see if there is no contrast, right? Like half and half.
That's exactly right.
So if there is full contrast, what do we see then?
So if there's full contrast, what we see is...
Yeah.
So the contrast is this depth of modulation.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.